pour yourself a beer or a cold libation. Let me tell you how I wrote this little theme. I went and took a call from Brother Jason, and he tells me that he has a little dream. He says he needs a backwards intro to begin his podcast, and I ask him, what you got? He said, I'll start off with some talking and some movie clips of popcorn fighting, fantasy explorations and some groundless exploitation. Kickstarts that I'm watching and some blind unboxing, school month or movie marathon. Sometimes I'll let the dogs come on, contest and of course you know it's all about games. That's a slogan, let's just start with the name. It's the Nerds RPG Variety Podcast. The other Jason.
Welcome back to the Nerds RPG Variety Cast. I'm your host, Jason. I have a very special guest today, and we're going to talk about a movie that we both love very much. This all built out of a phone call. And I'm going to let you hear that phone call here in a moment. But first, I'm going to apologize to you. The show might be, I think it's a good conversation. It's maybe a little low energy. Sorry about that. I haven't done a ton of editing here, so there's some ums and ahs, those kind of things in there. And for some odd reason, I keep calling braces or suspenders bracers. When I'm saying bracers, I mean to say braces. So whenever you hear me say bracers, I'm talking about suspenders, folks. So I'll apologize for that in advance. Okay, let's hear the phone call that prompted this episode.
Hey, Jason. It's Anthony calling in, and not from the road for once. Now, I'm not saying there's a direct connection, but when you and Carl released the final installment in your 12-month-long epic commemoration of the incredible director of Cyborg and Dollman, I got sick. Once I knew that that series was over, I fell ill. Grown weak and lassitude has seized me. I think, if you don't want me to languish and then die, you need to consider making year-long movie reviews a regular staple of your show. Think of the lives that you will save. Think of the harm that you will prevent.
So after receiving that phone call, I decided to reach out to Anthony and ask him to come on the show and help me launch our 2024 retrospective. And we've got the perfect film to do that. In 1984, Walter Hill wrote, directed Streets of Fire. And then in 2008, Albert Pyun did Road to Hell, which is a sequel to, unofficial sequel to Streets of Fire. Road to Hell was Albert Pyun's 50th film. And we'll talk about that near the end of this. But even though we've done the retrospective for Albert Pyun, this is the perfect stepping stone between the two because Walter Hill will be the subject of our 2024 retrospective. And this will be the first part of that is a Christmas present to you listeners. So luckily Anthony said yes. So Anthony, how are you doing?
And there was much rejoicing. I'm okay. I feel vitality returning to me now that you've agreed to talk about Streets of Fire and more movies. So,
well, you know, it's interesting. We'll get into it, but Streets of Fire is definitely one of my favorite movies. There's a lot to love here, a whole lot to love. It's not a perfect movie by any means. It's definitely what you would call a midnight movie, right? But there are parts of this that do, like the opening and closing of this movie are some of the strongest opening and closing, some of the best done opening and closings in all of film. It's almost the perfect opening and closing. They balance each other out. They're perfect. And they're so good, you almost forget about some of the bad stuff in the middle until you rewatch it. So we'll talk about that. But that said, this is one of my favorite films. This is also a very gameable film. And it has some interesting ties to RPGs, too. So, and we'll discuss all that.
I think so.
Yeah. So maybe we'll start with this. Before we get into talking about the film itself, when was the first time you saw Streets of Fire?
The first time I saw it was quite a while after hearing about it. That's for sure. I remember the soundtrack hits being played on the radio and stuff like that, and it being tied to Streets of Fire. And then more and more of my friends started talking about Sledgehammer Fight. Did not see it in the theater. I'm going to say it was 1991 is when I saw it the first time. We rented it from a small little like boutique video place that had a lot of import films and other weird films. I saw the cover. I won that discussion that my girlfriend and I at the time rented and watched Streets of Fire, and both loved it. But, yeah, that was the first time.
This has a great theatrical release poster, and I'm using that for the clip art for this episode. It's almost kind of like a stylized woodcut. It's got reds and blues, and it's a really, really good looking poster for this one. It's so I guess the other thing we should ask here before we started, what did she think of it?
She didn't like it as much as I did, but she did like it.
Oh, well, that's good.
Creeped out by Willem Dafoe and
how have we not gotten Willem Dafoe as the Joker? I mean, you watch this and it makes you wonder. He would have been perfect as the Joker.
At any point, yeah.
Yeah, Tim Burton missed out. As I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, we are going to totally spoil this movie. You can find it. You have to rent it or buy it. I think, before we start spoiling things, I think it's well worth the $3.99 or whatever to rent it and watch it at least once. So I would recommend that, but we are going to go full spoilers. Would you agree with that assessment?
Yes. I think in any review that you might watch of it, or if you happen to watch the trailer, you will be spoiled. So I don't feel any need to say, oh, we can't talk about it.
Right. No, we're going to fully spoil this. This is it's a very interesting movie, because when you look at it, you wonder, where exactly does this fit in? Because we were talking before we started recording, and I think it's a midnight movie is maybe the best kind of category. It's not quite a musical, because we don't have the characters singing lines, but it's still very much in that kind of musical vein. I don't know what the right, you're more educated than I am on this, because of musical numbers and the whole movie, you know, it's got the soundtrack and goes with the beat of the soundtrack. So you have punches and action beats that go along with the soundtrack, you know?
Right. Absolutely. Edited, you know, syncopated to the, the track of the moment. And the music is a driving force in and around the plot. Like the tag of the movie, a mercenary is hired to rescue his ex-girlfriend. A singer has been kidnapped by a motorcycle gang. So, I mean, the main characters are deeply involved in the music industry. Music is their life. The character is going to be talking about music. They're living the rock and roll lifestyle, but not 1984's rock and roll lifestyle and not 1950s rock and roll lifestyle, but deeply influenced and shaped by both.
And that's not even to count. So we actually have a couple of different eras here, because we have the modern era that you're kind of 80s rock, you're kind of rock ballads. We think like Meatloaf, and in fact, it's the same
writer that propelled Meatloaf to stardom, Steinman,
I believe. I've got the page open. I'm looking, but yeah, and so you have that. We have the Sorrells, which are wonderful in here, which is what doo-wop, I guess. And then we have the what's the name of the rockabilly band in the, because that's the actual band playing. That's
right,
the
actual Bomber Hangout.
Yeah, the Bomber Hangout. They're the only actual. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're the only actual band and people singing their own music in this.
Right.
Interesting enough. But yeah, so you get different. You have rockabilly and you have doo-wop, and we have rock ballad. And it actually all fits together correctly. But each of those things kind of shows a different part of the city and different areas. I think the world building in here is amazing. And I think and it's fully realized, I think, for the city, at least, where it's happening.
It's so believable.
Yeah. Yes. And it's, well, it's a rock and roll fable, which by fable, I think he means a fantasy tale, not a fable as in a moral to the story, but a
like the bridge, like where we've got the 50s style diner where the, in all the descriptions, it makes the Michael Paré character, they talk about him being a mercenary, but in the film, it's soldier of fortune, which is a term I much prefer in this rock and roll fable kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But he has a sister. He shows up after years away to see his sister at this diner, and to get into this kind of 1950s safe zone kind of place, you cross this long, strangely lit bridge, you know. There's a lot of parallel in Celtic mythology there, you know, crossing over to the other side, to this more mystical realm kind of thing. And, you know, going back and forth between the hell zone where the bikers are. And it's fable is a good fit.
Yeah. I think so. And it's not a defined, it's not Chicago, New York. It's just another time, another place. We're never given the name.
Another time, another place.
Yeah. We're given names of districts in the city, but not the city name itself. And it's interesting because this isn't a graphically violent film. This is a time where you had, you know, Michael Mann doing things and De Palma and some other, this is definitely a neo-noir film, is with the emphasis on neo. And although it's also a noir film when we think about it, when we actually break the plot down, it's very much a fits in that noir category. It's also Western. Very much a Western plot, but it's also proto cyberpunk in some ways, which is really cool. This is Walter Hill's. He wanted to do this. He had finished 48 Hours, and 48 Hours was a huge hit. You know, no little thanks to Eddie Murphy and of course Nick Nolte as well. But 48 Hours was incredibly huge, and this was the next thing he wanted to make. He wanted to make something totally different. And not just Walter Hill, Larry Gross was his partner who helped him write and do all this kind of thing. But Walter Hill wanted to write he wanted to do a comic book movie, but he didn't want to do any specific comic book because he didn't like any of the comic characters that are out there. He wanted to make his own. And so that's what this is. And Tom Cody, our hero here.
Tom Cody.
Is
our soldier of fortune.
Our soldier of fortune is so this is kind of like his envision was like a Indiana Jones kind of character, and he would have multiple adventures, right? In fact, this was supposed to be the first of a trilogy. The next movie was supposed to be set in like a snowy kind of winter thing somewhere, and then the last one was going to be set in a desert. Of course, those never happened because this failed horribly at the box office. But
yeah,
it's interesting that this movie, although it failed in our box office, was very popular in Germany and extremely popular in Japan. And in fact...
Right, and here too.
Oh, in Korea? Yeah. So in Asia, it was... Yeah. And it's interesting because it was very influential, is in, you know, it showed up in Bubblegum Crisis. It shows up in Megazone 23. It shows up actually as an influence to cyberpunk, with Mike Pondsmith saying that the Rockaboy character kind of comes from this movie, which is kind of interesting because we'll talk about it. Diane Lane, I mean, she does a great job on stage in this movie. I think she's a little bit wooden off the stage, but she's only 18 when she makes the movie. But I'm not sure why it's the Rockaboy. This is the impetus for that, right? But
right.
Yeah. So it's interesting.
Locally, this film is often in the repertoire of the neo rockabilly bands. It might be their initial touchstone to the 80s elements that the psychobilly bands like to draw on, and that sort of stuff. But the hair, the leather looks, and that sort of thing was inspiring on a lot of levels. I still don't know how much I feel that it's proto cyberpunk in terms of genre, but it's hugely influential, it would seem, on actual cyberpunk creators.
Right.
You know, that ability to mesh different eras together to create your now seeming future.
Mm-hmm. Well, and
you know, like in cyberpunk, like in Shadowrun and whatnot, it's very much the politics of today, but with a mishmash of different influences, whether it's the music of the past or a music of the future or a fashion of the past or a fashion of the future, and that sort of stuff mixed together as the author desires. It definitely does that. It's a template for doing that.
Yeah. Right. And style is all important in this movie too. Now, I don't know that I agree with all the styles in the movie, but style is all important in this movie. You have to look good. You know, it's interesting that this movie, you could almost see when we look at it visually, the visual style, this could almost be set in the same country at the same time as Tim Burton's Batman.
Sure.
Not the same city, but this, you know, if that's Gotham, if that's New York, this could be Chicago in that world. Right.
Right. Easily. Yeah.
Yeah. You can see that. Which is kind of weird, but this plot of this movie, and we haven't really just.
Well, there's one more comparison there.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen, I hope you have seen it. And if you haven't, I hope you rush out to see it. But Six String Samurai is also in this kind of vein, this rock and roll fable. Now I shudder now after your recent episodes to use the term, it's labeled post-apocalyptic. But it also has this same element of connection to music, connection to fashion, blending of eras, and kind of archetypal characters pitted in easy to understand situations. Your typical moral choice, or you know, the choice of friends and family over some other consideration, and that kind of stuff. It's that kind of story.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting because this plot, even though this isn't cyberpunk as far as technology or any of that, this is very much a plot you could drop into any cyberpunk game and run with it or any Western, easily, or you could easily do this in D&D as well. This is because it's a fairly simple plot, but you could easily drop this into a lot of genres and run it. But I could see this as the prototype kind of mission you would give a group in cyberpunk, right? Because nobody else cares enough to go recover Ellen. So you have to do it. Police can't do it. Let's talk about...
The police can't. No one else will.
Right. Because you have some good cops in here. You have crooked cops in the movie, but you also have good cops. But unfortunately, the good cops end up getting outnumbered or they're not skilled enough early on in the movie.
Sure. Yeah. The bombers seem like a huge gang.
The bombers are a huge gang. Now, and interesting enough, they're not the only gang, because we also see the the Roadmaster in the beginning of the movie. When we're introduced to Tom, he breaks up another gang that comes into the bar. I forget what they were like. Right. Road something.
I
Road
like
Kings or something.
That scene a lot.
Yeah. so let's talk about. I want to talk about Michael Perry.
Paray.
Right. Yeah. All right. Let's talk about him last. Let's talk about the cast really quickly. We've got your singer here, Ellen Aim, is Diane Lane. And Diane Lane, of course, everybody knows her from movies at this point. Now, she had already been in some influential movies at this point, but she was only 18 when she filmed this. During the filming of this, her high school report card got brought tour on set, right? So, I mean, and yeah. Honestly, she's not actually singing the songs. She's lip syncing them, and they've got a combination of two different voices in there as the voice. But she, on stage, she's great. She pulls it off. She's getting into it. I think she was, the part was originally written for a 28-year-old lady. And, well, I guess that's one thing we should back up real quickly before we get too deep in here.
Sure.
Waterhill wanted this because of things like The Outsiders and some other movies have been popular with younger casts. They wanted this to all be a very young cast. And so I think they wanted everybody to be under 30. And originally they were looking at Daryl Hannah for this part, and she ended up getting Splash instead. But Diane Lane might have been a little bit too young for the, not like say she pulls it off leading the band on stage and all, but I think for the rest of it, she might have been a little bit too young for the part, to be honest. And I'm not picking on her, but and she's not given, and the plot or the script doesn't give her anything to work with either. That's, you know, the weakest part of this movie is the script by far.
Right.
Which is a shame. The
dialogue can come across as,
well,
as,
yeah, it's,
I want to find a word that isn't insulting. Well, like when you say the dialogue is flat or whatnot, there's
some of the actors pull it off though. So the dialogue, they're trying to go after that gangster, the '50s and the gangster movies and almost mob movie kind of talk. And some of the characters, like Rick Moranis, pulls it off. He actually really, you know, playing against type, but he does in fact, I think this came out before Ghostbusters at the theaters actually, or it was the same year, but he does really good. He carries it off. I think Amy Madigan also pulls off, does a good job with it. She's great. And
the dialogue requires a certain kind of sincerity.
Right.
And it might be the type that you'd use for a Captain America kind of character, you know, of mm-hmm. mom and apple pie and that kind of stuff. But it doesn't necessarily have to be that kind of theme. But when you see Bogart in his pivotal noir roles, he believes what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's, you know.
Yeah. I'll tell you who else. We have a really small part in here for Bill Paxton. He take care of it too. Want to see more Bill Paxton because he's great in this. But he just has a small part. But let's see, Diane Lane is our rocker boy, right? A rocker girl lady.
Yep.
She's like I say, she's great on stage. She really.
Yep.
The opening and the closing. Yeah, they're the strongest parts of the movie by far. She's great. Her manager is Rick Moranis, who plays, you know, and he actually is pretty darn good in this movie. Is Billy Fish is kind of the sleazy manager type, right?
Boyfriend good example manager. To use.
Yeah. Yeah, he's good. We have our sidekick to the hero, McCoy, played by Amy Madigan. This was originally, they were thinking...
Edward James Olmos for the character.
A bunch of different people were considered for this role, I think.
Yeah, this was written as a Hispanic male originally. And she talked him into letting her do this because they originally wanted her to read for Riva.
The sister.
Yeah, the sister, but she is great in here. And she's just got out of the army. She said there are no more wars or something. You know, why'd you get, you know, the wars were ended or something like that. And but she's great.
Really interesting world building in one sentence, right?
Yeah. Well, and of course our main character, Tom Cody, was also in the military and he goes, you know, well, I like to shoot the guns, but I didn't get any medals, is what he says when she tells him that.
Yeah, interesting. A team kind of feel.
Yeah, yeah. We have the sister we mentioned, Deborah Van Valkenburg. She was in, of course, the Warriors as well. There are a lot of Warrior vibes with this.
Yeah.
She's also in some Albert Pune movies that we talked about earlier this year. And she will reappear in the Pune's sequel to this. She is really good in this. I think she's, I don't know if she's underused because I don't know if that character really needs to be in the movie more. But I want to see more of her. Because I think she's really good in this.
Right. Yeah.
Of course, the other major person before we get to our hero is our villain. And that's William Dafoe, a young William Dafoe, who's great in this. He again, with dialogue, he pulls it off, right?
He's believable.
He's very believable, very menacing. His wardrobe, I would not have made the same choices, but
you don't want to show up in vinyl overalls with no shirt. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, he's basically wearing bib overalls made of leather. This black, it's crazy. You don't see that when he's riding on the bike, but like when he's walking around the club, that's what he's wearing. Yeah, with no shirt. Yeah. And of course he has the ducktail hairdo from the 50s. And he's,
yeah, but it's quite a quiff he's got going on. Yeah.
But if you ignore the outfit, he is a menacing, believable villain. He's great. And the entrance of the villains. So the movie opens up with the concert the concert's going great. Lots of energy, lots of power at the end of the song. But during the concert, the bombers show up, the biker gang shows up, and they filter into the room. And the way the lighting is, when you're looking into the audience, you see the faces of the audience, but the bikers, even though they're intermixed, are still in shadow. And then near the end of the song, there's a fade, and his face comes into view, and it's great. And then at the end of the song, he yells, "Get her!"
Get her!
Yeah. And they charge the stage, and he tackles her. And they beat up anybody that gets in the way, and they kidnap her and just take off with her. At which point, Reva writes to her brother. You see her typing on the typewriter, which probably should be a telegraph instead. But she's typing on the typewriter. You know, "Tom, please come home." And then we meet our hero, who's coming on the train, coming across, like you say, across that bridge into this area. And Tom Cody is played by Michael Parr.
Hooray.
Yeah. And I don't know. He is good in some other things. And I don't know that it's all his fault, but he is definitely the weakest link as far as the cast goes.
I think he had an awful lot put on his plate.
Yeah.
Like when he was younger, I don't remember when this came out. Like I don't remember what year it came out, but
this
he was
right after Eddie and the Cruisers. So.
Right.
Yeah.
But, where I first saw him, like where I came to know Michael Paré as an actor that I could match the face and the name to, right, was as one of the kids in the special needs classroom of Ralph Hinckley, the greatest American hero.
Yep.
Where he pulls off the combination of world weary, yet afraid of the future, misjudged by everybody, thrown away kid. He pulls all of that together, you know, that rough edges, fearful kind of character that is still able to warm up to Ralph Hinckley. In this film, I just wonder if he had enough time, because he had to learn how to ride a motorcycle. He had to deal with the guns and extensive choreography for the physical fights, and there's an awful lot of stuff to do. I wonder how much time he had to find the right pitch for the very sad, you know, like dedicated to his craft, you know, that he's a soldier of fortune, but why? He didn't get any medals, but why? He left the girl behind, but why? Right. I don't know if he had, found the place to deliver those lines.
Right, because you almost get the impression they want him to be like the man with no name and come in there like that.
Yes.
But the problem is they give him too much backstory, because he's got a sister and he's got an old girlfriend. He's got so he's not you can't do
he's
the
not,
mysterious.
He's got a name. Yeah,
you can't do a mystery. And he's got his buddy in town that knows him, right? Because we meet that's what Bill Paxton is Clyde. That's his old buddy, you know? And so there's too much background for him to be the man with no name, but they don't flesh it out quite enough. And he has said in interviews that he didn't think Water Hill really liked him. And maybe he was worried about being too needy, and he didn't quite get enough direction, he felt, from Water Hill, which I could see.
Right. Yeah. Cause Walter Hill is one of those, you're the actor, I'm the director types.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the wardrobe doesn't help him either, with the bracers you know, it's funny because they talked about casting a whole bunch of different people. One of those is Patrick Swayze. And I think Patrick Swayze would have pulled off the bracers and would have, I actually think he could have done this
Right. Better. This is in the Steel Dawn era, I think. Yeah.
He could have done this. I think Michael does the best he could, and he's not horrible in this. I don't think it's fair to blame the box office failure on him, but he is of the actors, he's the weakest link.
Very likely. Yeah.
Yeah. Sadly, but it's such an interesting movie when you look at it. We have a pretty strong cast all told.
Yeah.
We have great music throughout. You know, we've got
right.
You got the guy that wrote Meatloaf songs. We've got stuff done by Stevie Nicks, right? Sorcerer, the song in the middle, the music video when they're on the run there. You know, that's kind of Stevie Nicks, right? We've got the song where when he pulls out her before he decides to take the mission to go get her, and he pulls the old snapshot out. That's like a Tom Petty song, right? There's the music in here is super strong. The music
by The Fix.
Yeah.
And
I mean, it's great.
Who was it that did I Can Dream About You? Was that Hart? Somebody Hart? Daniel Hart?
Yeah, it's, I don't know. You are much more musically minded than I am. Sorry, folks.
But it was already a hit by the time the movie came out. As I recall,
Dan Hartman.
Yeah.
Dan Hartman. But it's interesting because they mixed this for Ellen's voice. Laurie Sargent and Holly Sherwood, they mixed their voices together for the voice, a powerful
voice they created for her. And she totally sells it as you mentioned, you know, it's not one of those. Not one of those My Fair Lady moments.
She's an angry singer, though. When you watch, she's got that. She almost looks angry. She's singing, and because she doesn't have an instrument, she's got to do something else. And she has this thing she does when she's not singing, where she's punching in the air. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But no, she sells it. You could see she's keeping beat. You can see her body moving and everything else. And she really does. Her outfits are good in this movie. So, you know, we mentioned kind of a couple weird costume choices, the bracers and the leather overalls,
which I liked. I just think that he accepted his wardrobe.
Yeah.
I imagine that Willem Dafoe spent a lot of time getting the hair right.
Right.
And the walk that he wants. I imagine a lot of that. I kind of imagine Michael Paré saying, "Is this my wardrobe?" And someone saying, "Yes," and him putting it on. And it's believable.
Mm.
But I remember actual people wearing such things. But it's not cool in the way, and it's not rock and roll fable in the way that other things, costume choices are.
Which is interesting because those two have the only kind of really odd costumes, I think, because I think everybody else's costumes look great. And I think William Dafoe pulls off his, but we don't have the bracers the whole time. So most of the time, Tom Cody looks duster. Fine, but it's just that, yeah, right. It's the duster, but whatever. He's just,
his color palette is beige.
Right. It's kind of, yeah. But I think everything else works really well costume wise and design wise. So I think that, you know, that's the only kind of weak thing there. The cinematography is just out of the park. I mean, I don't think he can criticize it at all. From the interesting wipes to the colors, all the neon, the different parts of the city feeling unique.
And the speed of it, like the film is 93 minutes, something like that. I mean, but it moves so fast, even in the slow parts. You know, even in the introduction, which is, you know, moving at a slower pace and, you know, getting your bearings, looking around the old neighborhood kind of vibe, it's still just moving and moving. Like, the editing is fantastic, you know.
Right. It's wonderful to, like I say, and what's interesting is, so most of this movie was filmed on a soundstage, and they couldn't do it at night, so they had to do it during the day. So they put a tarp over a few blocks of soundstage. They spent over $1 million to do this.
Right.
And it ripped off one time and caused, but this is this huge, huge tarp over blocks of soundstage to, you know, give them a night effect. But it works. I think the movie, even today, looks wonderful. It sounds wonderful. I don't think you can criticize either of those things at all.
That kind of overpass, right? Mm-hmm. The action,
yeah, Chicago.
And everything underneath the elevated trains. Mm-hmm. When I first moved to Seoul here in Korea, the city still had these elevated highways, really wide, multi-lane highways, cutting mm-hmm. through the heart of the city. And it was always in shadow underneath. It's always the first reference I would make when I went there. And weirdly, I bought my DVD copy of Streets of Fire underneath this elevated, you know, roadway, not too long before they tore it down and turned it into a gentrified, you know, river project. But that kind of vibe of these mm-hmm. stores and these businesses and these people kind of growing like mushrooms under, you know, in the shadow of the L is right. a very real phenomenon. It's very cool.
Yeah. I wonder if though one of the things that hurt this, because like I said, I don't think you can blame it just on our hero, but I think people weren't sure what they were getting here. Walter Hill decided to lean into the fantasy part of this, and because of that, he dialed back the violence. He you know, right. originally it was R, they brought it to PG, but originally at the end, Tom was going to pull out a knife and kill Raven during that final fight. That got scratched. Some other violence got scratched out. And I don't think that was the wrong decision, but I think it makes this a different kind of movie, where at the same time people are getting pretty violent films, and you know, you think of things like Thief, and you think of you know, these things, and then you come to this, you know, other neo-noir movies at the time, right?
Right.
So I think that might have turned people off. I don't think it's a negative, but I think it could have been at the time.
It's hard to have an anti-hero, a character who's set up through the arc of the film to be an anti-hero in Tom Cody, and then just make him a normal kind of, not that he does, and I don't want to sell Perret short either, because there are moments where he really gets it. They have to rescue the kidnapped Ellen, right? And so they've done that. They've got her, but they have to escape. And he chooses to stay behind, and he just delivers this kind of throwaway line. I'm going to play these guys for a little while, or something along those lines, and to create a distraction so that the girlfriend can escape. And it's totally believable. Like, I'm totally in there that this guy is the soldier of fortune that they're talking about. And he's just in a kind of, in a very self-destructive way, is dealing out this lethal violence, right? And in that Clint Eastwood Man with No Name way, it's like, well, there's no one else here to do it. This is the most efficient way that I can deliver the most destruction. And so the thought of consequence, the thought of, well, maybe I shouldn't kill people, this is absent, you know, in this character. You can see that dark core that leads him to this point of life that he's in, you know, alone, wandering the earth.
Right. We'll come back to that when we talk about Road to Hell. But you know, it's interesting because I think that might be the third strongest scene. I still think the opening and closing, maybe we count them as one, but they're the strongest parts of the movie, by far. But the rescue scene, which is in the middle of the movie, is a very strong scene. I think it's very well. The only issue with the rescue scene potentially is a little bit with the geography work, because he's kind of across the street from, you know, where he's shooting the bikes and blowing the bikes up, and she's you know, he's on the rooftop across the street from the building where he needs to get into, and then all of a sudden he's in that building. We don't see him, which we don't have to see him do that, but
we don't have to see him. But there's a little stretch of getting into the building, getting out of the building,
right? And then we have McCoy who goes in the building to, you know, do a distraction, do her thing, and that's where we see the blasters. We see the band in there doing their thing, yeah. which is great. You have the lady that was the body double in Flashdance. She's in there dancing, and she does an amazing job in there. Yeah. And McCoy does great because, you know, she gets the guy and she gets in and she's able to get the drop on. We're not giving everything away here because folks, you need to go watch it. But she gets the drop on Defoe and his lieutenants. So one of the reasons that Cody can do what he needs to do is that she's got the heads of the gang held at gunpoint during this whole thing because they're in this big card game and she pops in there is holding a gunpoint. And then when somebody rushes her, she shoots them. She's not, you know, afraid of violence. And but she holds him at gunpoint until Tom is able to save Ellen, which is great. I think that scene is very strong. The whole sequence is very well
really
done.
Really is. Yeah. And it's kind of our title scene, really.
Yeah.
You know, in the literal sense. You know, and then the famous sledgehammer duel is kind of a counterpoint to that.
And it leans much more to the western area there. So they've gotten back. They finally get back, and they get Ellen back. But then the bombers show up and they give the police an ultimatum. They say, you know, we want Tom Cody, because you have a showdown, and I'll play the clip between Defoe and Cody at the end of the rescue scene. I'll insert that right here.
Well, looks like I finally ran into someone that likes to play as rough as I do.
Yeah, this must be your lucky night.
I'm lucky? I guess maybe I am. But you're dumb. Real dumb if you think you can pull this off.
I think you're forgetting something. I got the gun.
I can get guns, smart guy, lots of them. Now, why don't you tell me your name?
Tom Cody. Pleased to meet you.
I'll be coming for her. And I'll be coming for you, too.
Sure you will. And I'll be waiting.
And so now, of course, Raven knows, the bad guy knows who he's looking for. So he comes, he said, I just want Tom Cody. I'll just show up with two of my guys, you know? And so the police decide, well, that's fine. And actually, that's okay. They tell Cody to leave, and they said, and they're playing, we're just going to arrest him. You know, there's Richard Lawson here, great actor. Yep. And who's the main off? He's like I don't know, he's the sheriff or the police chief, or I don't know exactly what he is, but he's in charge of the police here. And so he goes to arrest when they show up, when William Defoe rides up with two of his guys, you know, they're going to arrest him. And he's got, you know, a couple other officers out there with him. But then William Defoe pulls out that air horn and the visual of that, because they catch the air rippling around as the air horn's going off. It's so great. And then the bombers all come in, and a lot of bombers with lots of guns. And then Tom Cody shows up and, you know, the police chief looks at him and tells him, you know, well, my plan didn't work. Let's see how yours does.
Let's see how your plan works. Yeah.
And so they're going to have this one-on-one duel. And what do they pull out to have this duel? Is it, you know, switchblades? No, they're sledgehammers.
Sledgehammers. And this has grabbed so many people's attention in the different game groups I've played with since then. Hey, my guy could have a sledgehammer. It's like, where is this coming from? But I mean, you find it. It's all through the World of Darkness. It's just everywhere. The sledgehammer fight.
And this is a good fight. It took them 3 weeks to film this fight. 2 weeks with the principals, and then 1 week with stunt doubles and the crowds. But 3 weeks to film this fight. And this is a really good fight. I think the choreography is really good. It's well done. It's as believable as it can be with sledgehammers, right? Because nobody actually gets really hit with the head of the sledgehammer. When they're hitting each other, typically it's with the shaft or the handle, right?
Right. There's some pokes with the head in the chest. Like, no one's swinging for the head in this. It's not a I want to kill you, Tom Cody kind of thing. It's I want to beat you.
Right. But there's no scene where, like, you see somebody get their hand smashed with the head of the sledgehammer, and then they keep using it. So there's nothing like that to pull you out of, is what I guess where I was going with it. But there, it's a great fight. The ending is great, where, you know, they end up fist fighting at the end, and then finally, you know, Raven standing there, a bad guy standing there, he can barely stand up, and our hero goes over and just pushes him over, and he falls over. But this is a very Western thing, because the police are now overwhelmed by the gang, and then the heroes have to save it. That this would very much fit in any kind of Western, right? Because and the gang has the honor where they'll, you know, when their leader gets beat, they mount up and ride off. So
And these are one of my favorite visuals in the film, is the kind of greenish background and the headlights, you know. So many headlights coming through the darkness. It's like,
The bombers are great. Epic. Apparently, they did hire a bunch of Hell's Angels to fill out the ranks.
That's
the
what
bombers.
I hear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's not. But I don't know. It's interesting because everybody thought this movie was going to be a hit. They thought this was going to be a great movie. It was going to make stars out of everybody. And then it crashed. And of course, Diane Lane, actually, this is one of the reasons she kind of dropped out of film for a little while and did some other things, which is a shame, because she had done, you know, The Outsiders and she did some things with Francis Ford Coppola that hadn't been released yet when this came out. But this was considered as something that stagnated her career, which is kind of crazy. I don't know.
I mean, you can see where it comes from. I mean, this is early 80s. This is Much Music and MTV. You can see the influence of the music video on how that opening and closing sequence are put together. Mm-hmm. You know, how they tell the story visually, edited to the flow of the music. You know, it's just perfectly in harmony. And then we have to transition into more normal movie mode, you know, but supporting the music. Mm-hmm. But you know, we've got films like Flashdance. We'll have films like Dirty Dancing. We have successful films where this kind of tenuous connection between the music video is a part of production. So I think there was we can even think about the Rocky Horror Picture Show in some regard as well, as, you know, the success of this kind of music or this kind of movie, very over the top, singable, enjoyable music, strong characters, other kind of very otherworldly, you know, it's the world next door kind of feel. Yeah. 5 minutes into the future.
Right. The other one that jumps to my mind, of course, is always the Phantom of the Paradise when I think of these kind of rock musical movies. And that's I don't remember if that did well or not, though, when it came out. I don't remember if it did well or if it bombed, but that's another movie I love. That's much more of a musical, though, Phantom of the Paradise. But we do have our lead, actress actually singing, though. Jess Carper actually did sing those songs in those. She's got an amazing voice. But the supporting cast here, you mentioned Flashdance, and the second in command, I guess, of the gang of the bombers is Lee Ving from Fear, from, you know, the punk band Fear. And he was in Flashdance. He owned the Topless Club in Flashdance. And of course he was in Clue too. Of course, you know, anybody remembers the movie Clue, he was Mr. Body in Clue. he was
Mr.
The
Body has invited you to dinner.
But he's really good in that. That's the thing about this movie is, you know, you have some great actors in here, some great performances in here. And like I said, I think a lot of these lines, this is the kind of movie if you haven't seen it before, it's going to take you a few minutes, maybe 15 minutes. It's going to take a little bit time for your mind to switch the mindset. Okay, this is how the dialogue goes. This is the kind of dialogue they're going for. Because initially it might turn you off. And one of the reasons the opening is so strong is there's not really any dialogue. right?
Right.
It's so it doesn't throw you off until that scene that you love that we're going to talk about now, where we meet our hero and he shows up and it starts off strong. You know, he shows up at his sister's diner. He orders coffee, you know, black, and that's fine. But then the other gang comes in, the Roadmasters, I think that was what their name was. And there's another gang, and they show up, and they give her a hard time, and they start to tear up the bar. And then, of course, he takes his coat off, and we see his, you know, bracers in full glory. And he, they call him Pretty Boy. And the first real fight we get, well, that's not true. We get the fight where they steal Ellen, and that, you know, and that looks good, where she gets kidnapped. Or that looks like a regular fight, right? But then this is this kind of weird slap fight where you know, the leader of the Roadmasters pulls out a switchblade, and Tom takes away the switchblade, shuts it.
Or a butterfly knife.
Yeah, butterfly knife. I apologize. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, because the leader opens the butterfly knife. Tom takes it away, shuts it, hands it back, says, try that again. And then we have montage of him slapping it and taking the knife away.
Right, which put me really in mind of Cyborg, you know, the same hit duplicated, triplicated, you know.
Right.
But
I
learned later, this is an addition from Michael Paré. Mm-hmm. So the fight was meant to be quite different, but he demonstrated his comfort with knives and was able to pull this off. And so he really enhanced the scenes. This is another one of the reasons why I don't want to sell his involvement in the film short. He really brings it in a lot of levels, but I think learning how to be confident on a motorcycle, learning how to drive standard when you don't know, having to be the lead of a film when it's really not your first time, but certainly your first year of being considered leading man material. I think this is an awful lot to carry. I'm not sure he got the support he needed to bring that off, but this scene he delivers in spades.
Yeah. Right. And he does something here that I don't know if we see enough in RPGs. We need to make, and some games definitely support this, but so he grabs a coat rack and uses it as a makeshift weapon, an improvised weapon to clean house with the other guys. Right. And which is great. And, you know, their games often will have mechanics for that, but I don't know how often players take advantage of those mechanics.
There's definitely a perception that it will be punitive, right? Well, you can, but here's the list of minuses. There are a few games out there that do it the other way around, that make it additive. Well, you would be brawling otherwise, and so here's the benefit that you can gain. But a lot of them, it's like, well, you know, take this away, take that away.
Yeah.
Yes, the improvised weapon.
Yeah, and he does a good job there. And I don't know. It is a great movie. I hope people go check it out. Let's you have any final thoughts on Streets of Fire?
Hang on a sec. I just had a dog issue, which I need to take care of.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'll be coming for her. And I'll be coming for you too.
Sure you will. And I'll be waiting.
You are about to enter a world unlike any you've ever seen before, where rock and roll is king. The only law is a loaded gun. Where the beautiful...
Stay and see the show, it's really good.
The brutal...
I want Tom Cody.
And the brave all meet.
From now on, it's for real.
In Streets of Fire.
You're lying in your bed.
You don't have anywhere to go. You go down on the pedal and you
Now, from the creators of 48 Hours, Universal Pictures presents Michael Paré, Diane Lane, Rick Moranis, and Amy Madigan in a Walter Hill film, Streets of Fire.
All right, final thoughts on Streets of Fire. We have, I think, been apologizing for it a little bit.
Yeah, we have.
And I think part of the reason why it was not a huge success at the time was probably box office timing.
100%. It came out between.
I don't remember.
Yeah. Sorry, not to cut you off, but so just before this came out, well, Temple of Doom came
advertised.
Out. Yeah, well, that's a big part of it. Temple of Doom came out right before this, and then this was released the same week as, I forget. There's another huge film. This was released the same week as, so that hurt it quite a bit. But you're right. Yeah, the advertising, they didn't know what to do with it when Universal Pictures had this, and they had no clue what to do with this when it came out.
Right.
But I'm sorry. I'm jumping.
This is early Joel Silver, right? So
yeah,
he's usually behind a big production machine, but this movie didn't mm-hmm. get it. And I think they accepted defeat really, really easily. In that regard.
Oh, this was released the same day as Search for Spock, Star Trek III as well. So
so that's a big portion of the audience is definitely going to choose to go see that.
Yeah. You know,
like science fiction fantasy fans who actually can remember the 50s are all off searching for Spock instead of wandering the streets of fire, for sure.
Right. And people that don't have that are probably seeing Temple of Doom maybe for the second time or third time by this point. Right. Yeah. I realize not a lot of people like that. That movie isn't held in as high regard today, but at the time it did
kids,
very well. It
was, kids.
Yeah. Loved it. I loved it as
Temple
a kid.
Of Doom.
Yeah.
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 Absolutely.
Well, cause you got Short Round in there, right? Who should have inherited the hat.
Yeah,
that's what we should be seeing, and he can pull it off too.
Ki Hu Kwan.
I mean, he was in the Multiversal movie. What was it? Just came out.
Everything.
Yeah, that one. Yeah, he was in that. He should be in Indiana
awesome
Jones.
It.
Yeah, he. That yeah. Anyway, that's. It's a shame. This is one of those interesting points in Hollywood. Something that failed. Because if this hadn't failed, if this had done better, we would have gotten a bunch more like this probably. You would have got the copycats, and it would have been interesting. And Hill would have been able to make his trilogy, which would be interesting to see.
It might have been, yeah.
Yeah.
But
instead of that, we didn't get it. And so Walter Hill did not revisit this.
Right.
But this was a movie that Albert Pune loved. And you can tell that because when we look at some of his early movies, we have things like Radioactive Dreams, which is heavily influenced by this. We have things like Vicious Lips that is also heavily influenced by this. Both actually, right. I like those are better than, maybe not better, but I like the energy in those movies better than or more than some of his later movies because it's still more of a hopeful, energetic, fun feeling. Where by the time we get to Keen making the unofficial sequel to this, Road to Hell in 2008, we have him, he was in the mode that he wanted to replicate Sin City. So Road to Hell was shot much like Sin City and is not as well done. Road to Hell, you can find it, you can rent, there's one service online you can rent it from. You could find copies of it different places. You might even find it on YouTube if you look. Road to Hell is an interesting movie, this unofficial sequel. Michael Pray or
Paré.
Paré. See, that's the problem with me being English is my first language. But he returns as Tom Cody. Deborah Van Vogt.
Much older
returns.
Tom Cody.
Yes. Yeah. But he does pretty good in this, actually, for what he's given. but Reva returns. So they're the only two actors that return, but we know it's the same world. Clyde is referenced in there. Ellen's referenced in there. The actress they pick, we only see Ellen in flashbacks, and the actress kind of looks like her. What's funny is there's another actress in here who plays Gabriel the Archangel, and this is Joey Falco, who was on, I guess she was on Wife Swap too, but she's a singer. And she actually, when she sings at the very end, she looks a fair bit like a young Diane Lane. And she should have been cast as Diane Lane, not as Gabriel, the Archangel, because she has that angry singing like Diane Lane's lip sync. But so in this movie, Tom Cody has done his life as a soldier of fortune and is a paid assassin. And he's got more and more, you know, cold and done horrible things. And so he's now in purgatory. And well, they call it purgatory, but it's just the desert because they end up back in the city. Right. But he's in purgatory. But of course, like in many movies, the guff is empty. So Gabriel has to go recover a soul to refill the guff, or of course the world ends. And his is the soul that has to be saved to put back in the guff. Albert Pune thought that needed to be mixed into this, I'm not sure, but that's the direction we go here. So
there's our fable, our religious allegory for the afternoon.
Right. Sadly, Ellen had died. Billy Fish had killed or hired somebody to kill her. And her daughter, also named Ellen, is the she's kind of taken up the mantle, and she's actually played by a singer in this, which is great.
Right.
She is played by Roxy Gunn, who sings a number of songs in this, and she's good. She's
including decent. Tonight Is What It Means to Be Young.
Well, including all the main songs. She sings like all three main songs at the end of this movie. But she does good. She's decent. The very beginning of this movie is good. The very ending of this movie, once he gets to the city, is good. The middle of this movie is rough. It's all green screen, and the way that Tom gets his redemption is he comes across these two stripper serial killers, spree killers, and Caitlin and Ashley. And Caitlin's played by Claire Kramer, who does a really good job. All things considered, Claire Kramer is good. Courtney Peldon, who plays Ashley, doesn't do nearly as good a job. No offense to Courtney. She did better than I can do, but she is the weak link in this movie by far. But so these spree killers end up picking them up. Anyway, we go throughout this movie. You have long discussion segments. You have him punching them. You have all kinds of crazy stuff. And that's something we'll return to in a minute with Streets of Fire. But he ends up, Caitlin ends up killing Ashley, and then he ends up killing Caitlin, and then he gets picked up. But by killing them or causing them to be killed and them going to hell, somehow that redeems his soul. So now his soul can go back in the guff to refill it. But at the end of the movie, he meets his daughter, who, you know, obviously not seen, and they connect, and it's a little bit rough at first. But then he gets to watch her perform, kind of like watches Ellen perform at the end of Streets of Fire. And it turns out okay. And actually, like I say, the ending part's pretty good. If you start watching in the middle's rough, fast forward to the end of the movie. you won't miss anything by fast forwarding through the middle. I'm a huge Albert Pune fan, but this is kind of a rough watch. Not because like you're going to cringe, you might cringe watching it, but just because it's a rough watch. But the ending's pretty good.
Kind of a band-aid solution. Yeah.
Yeah, it feels like badly written fanfic, honestly.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a shame. So he punches these serial killers quite a bit in this movie, which whatever. But in Streets of Fire, he punches Ellen once to knock her out. And we didn't discuss that. But let's rewind really quickly. Was that they have a rough relationship. So he left to go in the army, but at the time he left to go in the army, her singing career was picking up, And he felt he would take second fiddle the singing career. So that's why he went in the Army. He couldn't stand being the guy holding the guitar, right? Holding her guitar. But she didn't leave him. He left her. But he comes back and he tells Fish, her new boyfriend, that, you know, he'll ask, pay him 10 grand to go save her. And he's, you know, Billy's willing to do that. At the end, he doesn't take the money. But when she finds out that he took money to save her, then she hates him for that. She tells him, I hate you for taking money to come save me. Because,
of course.
But they get back to the city. They know the bombers are coming the next morning. This is when the sheriff or the police chief told him, get out of town. And so he's escorting her out, but he ends up punching her, knocking her out, and then and then having McCoy get her out of the city.
Yeah.
Did he need to
drive off with her?
Was that? What do you think?
Again, this comes into the character is supposed to be an anti-hero. So a villain serving the cause of good or justice or whatever. You know, he's not supposed to be a good guy, although there may be remnants of a good guy inside. Hence the sadness, hence the reluctance to speak and the sometimes playful attitude that comes out. There's pieces of that happy childhood or whatever in there. But he's got also these very hard lines. There's lines that other people wouldn't cross. You know, like if you're in a sniper position in the street and you want to cause a distraction, you could be firing shots all over the place and people be running for cover. You don't necessarily have your first shot be to blow up the gas tank and fry this person you've never seen, let alone met, you know, and then do that again and again and again, just killing people without compunction. So there's something about this character that is very hard. And I think it's a very easy way for them to show that he's got this line, you know, but also in this world, like she gets kidnapped and taken away to this hideout and his sister writes a letter,
right?
Which then goes through the post and then wherever he is in the world and he comes back, back. So she's been in the clutches of this gang for quite some time by the time he shows up.
And you get the impression that things have been done. You know, it doesn't explicitly show that, which is fine. I think an argument could be made here, though, that nobody dies during this movie. You know, they have this discussion before they get there when they're driving over to the battery, where Rick Moranis' character tells him, you know, you're not going to help the situation by killing a bunch of bombers. And Tom says, I don't have to kill anybody. I just have to shoot up their motorcycles. And we don't necessarily split. We don't see anybody running around on fire. We don't
true.
See the only person we see actually catch a bullet is the one that McCoy shoots in the poker room scene.
Right.
So I don't know that he actually.
Right.
You can watch
no
this movie.
Set. It's not Commando with its body count of 260 people.
You could watch this movie and him and easily believe he didn't kill anybody. Or maybe Al Pugh watched it with kind of the impression you had, where he kills dozens of these bikers, and this hardened character is the one that, you know, socks Ellen to knock her out, and then of course, you know, he throws at least probably half a dozen times he punches these spree killing strippers in the sequel, right? But I don't know. It's interesting. He didn't come across. I think that's a failure of the script. And maybe the acting a little bit, but I didn't get him as that burnout, you know, guy with the 1,000-yard stare kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he's willing to do things that others, or, you know, risk himself where others might not, and that sort of stuff. I definitely think blowing up the bikes that those people didn't walk away from that experience, but it's possible. But I also don't get the impression that he and Ellen had an abusive relationship. I don't think he's in the habit of you know, hitting, mm-hmm. hitting friends or lovers or family, that kind of thing. But I think his time in the army, his time in these wars, his times not earning medals, I think they, you know, pushed him toward a certain expedience. You know, we could stand here arguing about it, or, you mm-hmm. know, get in the car.
Right. I think that's right. I think that's a valid reading of that. Definitely. Yeah. It's interesting. The way this falls out, because you wonder how long has he been in the army, and what has he done at this point?
Yeah.
And then of course, then you wonder how old was Alan when they were going out before he went in the army? Mainly because right. we have 18-year-old, you know, Diane Lane in the right. part. But
well, I mean, we're supposed to imagine they're the same age, right. I think.
Yeah, I think so. And again, that's not her fault, but by any means.
Yeah.
And if Daryl Hannah had been cast, I don't think that would, you know, be an issue at all.
Right.
You wouldn't think.
I don't know if she would have had the right quality, but it's hard to say because, you know, it's she certainly delivered a fantastic turn as Pris in Blade mm-hmm. Runner. So.
Oh, 100%. And you know, it's interesting. You mentioned that. So we do get a couple last minute trivia things, and we'll wrap this up. Apparently, they weren't sledgehammers; they were spike mauls, which are what you use to drive railroad spikes into the cross ties. That's what they were fighting with. Which that makes a little more sense because you have a lot of railroads through. We see a lot of railroad tracks during this movie, right? And in fact, the stunt coordinators and stuff said some of the most dangerous stunts in the movie were when they were just fooling around on the bikes before the rescue, and you see them doing the jumps and the wheelies and stuff. Because they're all around those train tracks. And, you know, if that one of those motorcycles hit those train tracks the wrong way, obviously, you know, you'd lose it. So the other kind of interesting piece of trivia here is, and if you watch The Adventures of Ford Fairlane, and I know a lot of people may not want to watch that. I have a soft spot for that movie myself. But if you watch The Adventures of Ford Fairlane, one of the band names that comes up on the screen is Ellen Aim and the Attackers, the band from this movie.
I didn't notice.
Yeah. When you see all the list of the bands and all, whether you know with the plot, I don't know if you've seen that movie or not, but this is one of the bands that pops up there. So,
well, I mean, there you go. I mean, that shows how it regardless of commercial success, a lot of these films that are near and dear to gamer hearts influence a lot of other people as well, you know, mm-hmm. comic books and anime, as you were mentioning, and other films and other directors and other writers. And
So I think both of us would say go out and watch this. Maybe.
Definitely.
You know, Rob over down the heap, it's not a musical. The characters do not break out in song. The only songs sung are actually during musical performances by bands that aren't forced into the plot.
They're actually performing,
right? So I think it's safe for you to watch this, Rob. You won't have to lose any cred for watching a musical. And I'd be interested in your thoughts. I'd be interested in anybody's thoughts. If anybody has any thoughts on this movie, comment, maybe their experiences with Streets of Fire, please call in. All the information is in the show notes. And also go check out Anthony's stuff. Let me give you a minute to plug your projects right now.
Oh, well, we're in the middle. Maybe it's the middle of an exploration of imagination. You know, when we're playing role-playing games, how do we imagine? What things do we choose to imagine or not imagine? Do we choose not to imagine? And I'm kind of hoping that if people have time, they can call in and talk about their experience, you know, briefly. Please send a 1 to 5 minute call about, you know, in a scene, in a role-playing game, what is your imagination like? You know, are you a visual imaginer? Does that include, you know, are you able to imagine what something sounds like or smells like? You know, do you have fun doing that? Do you have a habit of doing that? That kind of thing. So we're talking about imagination and how that can lead us on into, you know, the holy grail of immersion And, you know, one person's immersion might not be another person's immersion. And going along with that is we're playing Call of Cthulhu and sharing that as an actual play. And using a varied group of players. So sometimes there's a lot of players in the scene, and sometimes there's only one person there in the session. We have different groups investigating in the same city around the same time. And so it's been, that's been kind of fun.
Excellent.
That's what's going on.
Yeah. There'll be links to the YouTube channel and the podcast for Anthony in the show notes. So check that out. And if you're interested in joining me next year to talk about a Walter Hill film, reach out to me, let me know. There are a number of great films that Walter Hill did.
Yeah.
So we'll definitely need co-hosts to discuss those. And I think the last thing, although some of the main holiday season is over by this point for some of the holidays, I do hope everyone either had or is having or will have a wonderful holidays. I hope you're able to spend time with your families and enjoy that. And I look forward to talking to everybody in the new year as well. Anthony, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Okay. Best of the season to everyone.
Yeah, definitely. So folks, be excellent to each other.
Joke about your spouse, but the operator's screaming it's coming from inside the house. What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? Well, the audience is pretty sure he took a pretty head, and the only question left is if I could shoot him dead. Bring on the gore, bring on the gore. Is a dustman and your moiler's by the tipper, and I'm assuming that your partner back there in the wood chipper. Don't look away. Don't look away. Well, the zombies are arising and the world's gone to heck. We're living for the dying and we're dying for the train wreck.